You are listening to Radio Albion.
One, you are listening to yet another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. I am Matthew Raphael Johnson, and today's date is September 7th, 2025. And I received a text recently from a new friend of mine who said that today's topic might be a good idea. And I had dabbled in it before. I've mentioned it in bits and pieces. I did an entire lecture, one of my favorite papers I've done, on Mussolini and his incompetence and stupidity in foreign affairs. But more specifically, today, we're going to talk about, well, two very closely related things. The German occupation of Greece, and, of course, that implies Mount Athos during the Second World War. And you can't talk about this topic without talking about Mussolini. I could talk about how incompetent and stupid Mussolini was all day. The media was the entity that created this Italy-Germany axis. Italy was nothing but a threat and a problem to Germany. He was ignorant. He was incompetent. At least in foreign and military affairs, he sought to build himself up as a powerful and feared leader through his use of the Italian military to impress everyone around him, especially Hitler. Now, that would be funny if it hadn't led to the slaughter of thousands of Italian men and the destruction of many of the Axis plans in Europe. It's unfortunate that Mussolini is the one who has caused today's low estimation of Italy's military reputation. Under Mussolini, it was very poorly trained and supplied. Certainly, this has nothing to do with the rank and file. The blame lay with the leadership. Worse than that, he helped create the NDH in Croatia, whose violence was so severe against the Serbs that it absolutely forced Hitler to invade Yugoslavia and calm the chaos that Il Duce had created. Mussolini was a drag on the Axis, an important reason why Hitler didn't have any chance to begin with. But when you have this barnacle attached to you, the pretension of being a great power, he really had no chance. In both Greece, Yugoslavia, I should even add North Africa, Mussolini's impulsive actions forced Germany to rescue him, thereby destroying Hitler's long-term plans and committing him to wars in which he wanted no part. Let's be clear, Hitler never wanted to be involved in any war with Yugoslavia or Greece. He never wanted to occupy any part of Greece. He didn't want to make an enemy of Greece, let alone Mount Athos. Il Duce helped destroy the Axis. He humiliated himself in almost each and every military campaign of his reign. In North Africa, he forced Hitler to divert desperately needed resources from the Soviet War. Then Mussolini ordered the invasion of Egypt a few months before the Greek campaign. Nothing happened. No one listened to him. Rommel just abandoned his Italian divisions in Libya, pretending he just forgot about them. In 1941, the Italian 10th Army was annihilated in North Africa by the much smaller British force in Operation Compass. I've talked about this many times before. 150,000 Italian POWs were taken. By themselves, the Royal Italian Army didn't have a single victory in this war. There were some with German assistance. But when Germany would win a victory against the Allies, Mussolini would claim that these were the results of his military acumen. And worst of all, 400,000 Axis troops were lost because of Mussolini's arrogance in Africa. Had Italy not pretended it could win there, maybe, the 21st century would look a little differently. Hitler's campaign against Greece and even his strategy in North Africa were constructed to rescue Mussolini and save the reputation of the Axis. So unfortunate that other than the Italians, no large nation in Europe functioned as an ally of Germany. Spain was neutral, and only the smaller states like Bulgaria and Romania allied with Germany for a time. Italy was the only game in town, at least for a while. And it was unfortunate, especially in Hitler's mind. Mussolini was an army deserter with minimal, almost zero, military experience, and he was surrounded by war heroes. He was perpetually threatened, he was immature, insecure, and he was a pompous histrionic that destroyed all he touched. Hitler disliked him, and more importantly, Hitler never respected him. So what we're going to talk about today is Hitler's very reluctant invasion of Greece, and hence his policy towards Mount Athos in particular. So we're talking about two separate things. The Germans in Greece more generally, and its policies on Mount Athos more specifically. Of course, they're interrelated. You can't talk about one without the other. But, you know, for your typical Westerner, Mount Athos is entirely mysterious. Athos doesn't possess weapons or any kind of territorial ambitions. It's much easier to deal with and much less pressing aspect of general policy from the German point of view. Now, as far as Athos is concerned, in the early 20th century, Athos was in trouble. It was an era of decline. It's a very bleak picture. After the liberation of Athos from Turkish rule and its annexation to Greece, most people thought that a new era was dawning and the Greek monasteries would benefit from it. These hopes were also connected to the fact that at the same time a catastrophe of Russian monasticism was taking place, hundreds of monks were expelled, and those who remained after the revolutionary events of 1917 found themselves in a very difficult situation. We'll talk about that very closely here in a second. The decline of Russian monasticism in Athos gave hope to many Greek church leaders who, in the beginning of the 20th century, did not like the extraordinary increase in Russian monks on the Holy Mountain, centered on the Rusticon and its skeets. Even the monasteries, nominally dependent on Greek ones, like Andrivsky and Ilinsky. But there was no flourishing of any kind. After the expulsion of roughly 2 million Greeks from Asia Minor in 1922, the Greek government ordered a transfer of land holdings of the Athenite monasteries, especially those in Chalkidiki, the peninsula, to accommodate refugees. In return, government was going to pay them, but that turned out to be minimal. They had minor land holdings outside of their little peninsula. So, financially, spiritually, most of the Athenite monasteries found themselves in a very difficult situation from the turn of the 20th century to the 1950s. The decision of the Greek authorities hit the Russian monastery especially hard. It was now deprived of that aid that had previously come in abundance from Russia. But even those monasteries, perhaps, hoped to rise against the backdrop of declining Russian monasticism, were forced to drag out an existence only slightly better than that of the Russian monasteries themselves. Now, what are the reasons for this decline? There were many. the most obvious, is that the world was simply becoming more secular. It was being driven that way by leftist revolutionaries. I don't want to use the passive voice there. People were making it that way. In the war against the Germans in Greece, the communists provided the overwhelming majority of the infantry. And of course, they were rewarded by the Allies afterward. And the same thing for Sicily and South Italy. But there's more than that. There was a loss of their metochia. A metochion is a representative center of a monastery, usually in a capital city, that tends to the monastery's affairs in terms of supplies and everything else. These had been removed. Making matters worse, there was something developing. There were numerous things developing that, within the secular revolutionary backdrop, was damaging everything. The monks in Athos like to talk about idiorhythm. Idiorhythmic charters that were preserved in many monasteries scared off many who wanted a more structured life. I mean, it began in the last decades of the Byzantine Empire, became widespread in Greek monasteries in general, and on Athos in particular, during the Ottoman period. It made some sense with the realities of the Ottoman era. It allowed them to survive under the tax burden there. But as early as the 16th century, the Patriarchs of Constantinople began to call for the revival of the true traditional monastic typikon, like that of Patriarch Jeremiah II, 1573. And the beginning of the 19th century, many of the monasteries on Athos were changing over. Remaining ones, including the most ancient and famous, St. Athanasius, Ivaron of Atopiedi, preferred to remain with the idiorhythmic charter. Or rule, I should say. Within this monastery, there'd be small communities developing, each which would live under the guidance of an elder. That might work. Idiorhythm really only makes sense in the skete or the hermitage, but certainly not in the cenobia or the large monastery under a rule. In the 20th century, let me quote you the numbers here. After the liberation of Athos in 1912, there were about 7,500 monks. More than half were Russian. By 1947, there were 3,000. By 1963, there were 1,500. After that, that number declined at a rate about 50 monks per year. By the year of my birth, 1971, there were only 1,146, at least those that were registered there. I'm not forgetting about the name-glorifying doctrine or name-worship doctrine that actually led to Russian military action on the mountain, removing the followers of it. That means the Russian monastic population before World War I, which was something like 3,500 in 1910, was under 2,000 by 1914. And the name, we don't have time to go into it. I've dealt with it many times in the past. Name worship thing was often considered an ethnic division. You know, I've dedicated my life to Orthodox nationalism. And yet there's one place where that sort of thing doesn't apply, and that's Mount Athos. After the war, of course, you had a civil war in Greece. Everything was sapping the strength. The Balkan Wars in early 20th century. Country was going through a period of just utter devastation. The brain drain from Greece was massive. Those forces that may have gone, and if it was they're still under the Ottomans, to the monasteries on Athos now went abroad. I've already mentioned the Asia Minor catastrophe of the early 1920s. I've mentioned this several times before. During the Greco-Turkish War, the population of Smyrna was entirely massacred in 1922 as the Greek front collapsed. Then there's a calendar reform, the 1920s. It affected everybody. Most Orthodox in Greece had no doubt that this so-called reform was Masonic and was a first step towards union with the various Western churches. The patriarchs and bishops, abbots and priests who talked about this, they provide enough evidence of it. The protests against it were the old calendarists. I am known to be one. Now, the Greek government wanted the reforms to stop. They wanted peace in the church more than anything else. But by the time it took any kind of action, it was too late. There are plenty of people following the old calendar anyway. And in Athos, everyone did. But it created yet another bone of contention within a church that is very, very, very well known for creating bones of contention. And if none exists, they'll invent one. Then, of course, that group splintered endlessly to the fact that I've given up trying to follow anymore. They had a strong witness against the world, but you can't have a witness anymore when you're split up into a million factions. So that was the situation on Athos. Now, during the 20s and 30s, Mussolini attempted to create an Italian empire that would unite Turkey, Greece, Bulgaria, and Hungary, Libya, and Abyssinia. Now, when the Depression hit, one of the first things that happened is that weak countries then become dependent on the stronger ones. But Italy never had the capacity for that. They weren't able to create any kind of federation. They weren't a very strong country at the time. Il Duce's inflated estimation of Italy's military strength was the start of his disastrous approach to foreign affairs, and especially his coming invasion of Greece. Greek Prime Minister Venizelos, who I've talked about many times before on this show, signed the Balkan Pact that joined Greece, Yugoslavia, Turkey, and Romania together. So it was meant to counter Bulgarian and Hungarian revisionism, as we call it. Now, that union would have been Italy's worst nightmare. It was the second Italo-Ethiopian War that led Greece to move closer to England. However, that's always a fool's errand. There was a very great man who ran Greece, Metaxas. Once that government grew in power and displaced the liberals under Venizelos, German trade became the mainstay of the Greek economy. You know, this is under the National Socialists. However, he wouldn't interrupt his relations with London. Metaxas, who was trained in Germany, backed the Germans in the First World War, always maintained ties with Britain, largely because no one trusted Mussolini. No one saw Mussolini as a competent military leader, but they still realized that he could create a tremendous amount of mischief. The British rejected all offers from Metaxas, mostly because he sought to finance projects internally from his own money and not rely on British loans. So that was out of the question then. This alienation may have given Mussolini the idea that the UK would not supply the Greeks or support the Greeks if he were to attack, but I don't know. In 1939, February, Mussolini addressed the Grand Council in Rome on foreign policy. He said, "Britain is the vital enemy of both Italy and Greece." Soon after, Italy took tiny Albania. With Italy making all these promises to sponsor this great Albanian state, said the same thing to the Croats, even to the Hungarians. The Greeks, not being stupid, began arming themselves for an Italian invasion Il Duce was unpredictable and unstable. However, the Balkans, even at this point, had had enough of war. The Italians pandered to the Albanian opinion to gain an ally against Greece, but still there was no trust. The few Albanian units that were raised to fight alongside the Italian invading army either deserted or fled. There were some that operated behind enemy lines and they engaged in sabotage, but these two, they were very few in number. You had Greeks living there, Greeks in Albania, who were very happy to see them once Mussolini was driven out. The Italian press engaged in anti-Greek propaganda, almost bordering on the cartoonish. Of course, Greeks did not threaten him under any circumstances. Mussolini pretended that the Greeks were nothing but stooges of London, despite Metaxas' German economic tie throughout his rule. But it was in October 16, 1939, the Italian chief of staff, Marshal Pietro Badoglio, received orders to begin planning for an invasion of Greece. You know, it's interesting. It's showing his opinion of his leader. When Il Duce was overthrown, that's the man who was the Allies put to replace him in 1943. But England still wanted Italian neutrality in any conflict with Germany, and told the Italians any war against Greece would harm Italy. And they were right. But Mussolini didn't like hearing that. Metaxas sought to communicate with Mussolini on a rational level, who stated, you know, disingenuously that Italy would support Greek neutrality. He denied any invasion preparations, although that's very tough to hide. However, Mussolini still worried about British guarantees to Greece. Mussolini delayed any attack and sought better relations with Athens, despite the propaganda campaign. Now, the British, you know, Metaxas had the British where they want, you know, they were opposed to Metaxas' pro-German trade policy, but also couldn't alienate them. So Metaxas had them where he really wanted them, at least temporarily. The Greek military was very highly respected and very experienced. They could still be a weapon against Yugoslavia. So then Mussolini started wavering on any invasion plan. But in Mussolini's mind, Greece was simply too small and weak. It'll be a quick victory. It would add to his prestige. And he wanted to prove himself to Hitler and to improve his reputation at home. I'm saying that that's a very important part of the reason why he decided to invade the country. The key event was the German defeat of France in 1940. Then the Italians thought maybe they had a free hand. Then there was a new Anglo-Greek trade treaty, the presence of British ships in the Aegean Sea. Again, the British thought to cut off Greece and Italy from Germany as much as possible. It would have been an economic disaster for both, but that was the British opinion. That was their policy. Germany was single-handedly bringing all of Europe out of the Depression. Britain was no help and was suffering that Depression just like the U.S. was. But using Rothschild and British financial resources, Greece became a part of the Allied camp, though very much against her will. But don't think for a minute that trade with Germany was ever cut off. Clearly, Mussolini's ham-handed diplomacy was shallow and shifting. He didn't understand the subtleties of European politics. He also didn't understand how his threats would bring Athens into the British orbit. Because of that, potential ally against Yugoslavia was lost. And Hitler was outraged at Mussolini's stupidity. Remember, the creation of Yugoslavia after World War I, this was a very large state in a region of fairly small ones. after the Italians invaded Greece, Hitler met the Italian foreign minister, Galeazzo Ciano, who was Mussolini's son-in-law, where he ripped them, just absolutely excoriated him for creating really an opportunity for the British to enter Greece and to establish an air base in Athens. That never really occurred to Mussolini, of course, but that put Britain within striking distance of Romanian oil fields, the sole source of fuel for Germany. That meant that Hitler would have to divert forces from North Africa to bail Mussolini out, which is comic only because German intervention in North Africa was itself to bail the Italians out. I mean, Hitler did consider just leaving them to fight their own way out, making peace with the Greeks as a way of forestalling any Allied intervention, but there was a tremendous reluctance. The invasion of Greece was done with an eye roll. In April 1941, Hitler called Il Duce a mad little clown more than once. Hitler rescued Italy in Greece and Africa solely to save the reputation of the Axis, not out of any devotion to the Italian leader. Hitler was opposed to any independent Italian action in the Balkans. He had zero faith in Mussolini's military ability. Hitler's high command knew how poorly organized the army was in Italy and how poor of a leader Mussolini was. That means any independent action would be a disaster. I mean, Mussolini even wanted to invade Yugoslavia, but Berlin forced him to cancel this. And this is right at the dawn of Operation Barbarossa. This is all the Germans need, right? Don't underestimate the idea that El Duce cared about his reputation as a military leader and will sacrifice a lot to this end. The invasion of Greece was imminent for that very reason, not for any real rational one, because it wasn't a rational thing to do. Because Hitler never told the Italians about his campaign south to capture Romania's oil fields, Mussolini, he felt very slighted. He wanted to do something without telling Hitler about it. That immature train of thought forced Mussolini to push the invasion date closer, regardless of his army's ability. He even fantasized that Italy could occupy all of Greece. Badoglio worried that an actual occupation of the entire country was way beyond Italy's capacity, even if a full general mobilization existed. Italy had been at war for a decade. Her industry, small as it was, at the breaking point. Badoglio tried to explain to Mussolini a massive increase in the army was necessary for this. And his response, of course, was to threaten him with his job. Mussolini couldn't understand that the poor state of the Italian economy could not handle even a temporary occupation of a country. Greece had done nothing harmful to Italy, so false flags would have to be staged in order to provide an excuse. The Italians feared British intervention, but German interference too. Germany and Italy were non-allies at the time, not in practical terms. Hitler always wanted to keep Il Duce at arm's length. However, Greece had plenty of allies, and Yugoslavia was well aware of Italy's intentions. And to a great extent, the war was really aimed at them. Mussolini wrote to Tsar Boris III of Bulgaria for assistance with the upcoming invasion, and he refused. For the same reasons. No faith in his abilities as a military leader. So Mussolini then convinced himself that even without Bulgarian assistance, the fear of it, or the possibility of it, will force Greece to split her forces in two. That was, again, another error. An army of 150,000 Italians against a Greek army of over 115,000 was really the order of battle, but they differed very much in terms of quality. The Greek were battle-hardened for two decades of constant warfare. But really, few Italians had any combat experience, except for a few who fought in Spain and some who fought in Africa, but that really doesn't count as typical combat experience. Back in 1936, General Alberto Pirani became chief of staff of the army. He organized Italy's combat organization to reflect the new stress on speed and motorization. But Italy didn't have any of that. She was still what we would call third world in her mechanization. There was a huge chasm between imagination and physical reality, and it just created more chaos. This is something that Il Duce refused to understand. And it was no shock to anybody that Pirani had a very low opinion of Mussolini. Strangely, for some reason, just prior to the invasion, Mussolini let 300,000 troops and 600,000 reservists go home for the harvest. This is why no one took him seriously. There were supposed to be almost 2,000 trucks delivered for the attack, but only 100 arrived. Mussolini didn't understand. You know, he had the same conception of warfare that the American media does. No concept of logistics or logic. Arrogance, a sense of superiority, and the wild overestimation of the Albanians and himself all went in the decision to invade Greece, and of course it failed miserably. Making matters worse, talking about 1940 here, Mussolini personally assumed control of all three military branches. Again, he was an army deserter under the monarchy, the Austrian monarchy, I should say. Mussolini's military service on paper was, I think, for 2 years, and he did it only for as a condition for later amnesty. He deliberately kept the high command few in number, so no coup could ever be planned against him. For the same reason, Mussolini reduced military organization in the chain of command to a point where communications were often impossible. This meant that field commanders had to plan their operations with no input from above. There was no central control over the military, and hence the branches, as well as units in the field, had to function independently. Mussolini's understanding of military doctrine or army life was close to absolutely zero. So the attack finally came. The invasion started October 28, 1940. The Italians stationed in Albania. And the Greeks were well aware of this. They had been digging in for a very long time. Actually, they were preparing for a joint Italian and Bulgarian invasion, but their worst-case scenario never occurred. The Greek Ministry of Defense was focused on Bulgaria. The Albanian front wasn't really seen as a major threat. The mountains were a massive a natural barrier. Ioannis Metaxas, a great nationalist leader, was unconvinced at the possibility of victory and leaned too heavily on English backing. Once it became clear that there was no threat from the Bulgarians, the entire Greek army could be sent against the Italian. The population had a tremendous optimism here. Saw Italy almost as a mockery under Mussolini. Not Italy per se, but Mussolini's buffoonery and incompetence, that gave the Greeks the optimism that would soon bear fruit. So Hitler's boarding the train after a terrible negotiation with Franco, where Franco said, "I'm not going to help you in the war." That's when he was told that Mussolini invaded Greece. And Hitler was furious. The quote is, "This is madness. If he wanted to pick a fight with poor little Greece, why didn't he just attack Malta or Crete? It would at least make a little sense in the war against Britain in the Mediterranean." Well, not only did he pick a fight with poor little Greece, he lost. Hitler immediately went to Italy. Mussolini met him at the station and said, "We're on the march." one of his made-up uniforms that he created. Victorious Italian troops crossed the Greco-Albanian border at dawn. The idiot didn't realize he had destabilized Germany's entire southern flank and refused to tell anyone about it. Now, I go into great detail on the Greco-Italian War. This is quite some time ago on Radio Albion, a lecture like this. I'm not going to go into it that much today. See, even if things went poorly for the Greeks, there was no stability in the chain of command. Mussolini would appoint people and fire them. The Greeks knew it too. They went on the counterattack, retaking whatever region, especially they had lost the region around the Kalamas River, the only gains really of the war, and reversed it right away. Reinforcements came from the Bari Division. A few Italian elite divisions did very well, but that was about it. The Greek Navy was using its submarines to cripple Italian shipping. They sunk maybe 23,000 tons in a month or so, maybe less. They didn't have many subs, but it was enough to cause him trouble. And that was done in a semi-alliance with Britain. Not that Metaxas ever loved the British. He understood the Rothschild question. He absolutely did. But he also knew his situation. Italian pilots, the handful of bombers that they had, pilots were never briefed on their missions. Many of the Italian troops were killed by these Italian bombers. It was an absolute and complete disaster. This is one of the reasons he was strung up in 1945. Thousands of Italians and Albanians unnecessarily died of disease. Mussolini showed the true nature of his worthlessness when he said after snow on Christmas Day, "The snow and cold are very good, and this way are good-for-nothing men, and this mediocre race will be improved." In other words, he thought that the death of these Italian boys were a good thing, so only the best later on would take over, which didn't make a whole lot of sense. He said, "The human material I have to work with is useless and worthless." He took no responsibility for his failures. He went so far as to blame his own men, the inferiority of his own men for the. And this, mind you, coming from a man who deserted his own army during World War I. Albania was then taken by the Greeks. The Italians were driven out of the area in panic. Yes, there was some assistance from the British. But this was a problem that Hitler had. And we're getting now, it's taken a while to get into the topic here, but you have to understand this. This is why Hitler did what he did. That's his mentality. Yes, there was a spring offensive on March 9th, 1941. Now note the date. Massed artillery. Extreme incompetence. None of this had any effect. The Greeks had captured an Italian officer that had the complete set of plan for the operation in his possession. So everything that the Italians did, especially in artillery, everything landed in an empty field. And yet he would go up on the mountain, just overlooking this Nisa Valley, about this ill-fated artillery barrage. No one knew the Greeks were everything. For the next 5 days, Mussolini, he made a fool of himself. He'd march back and forth. This is Marshal's baton. His forces were repulsed time and time again quite easily. He was forced to cut off any further attacks, and his forces were exhausted and humiliated, and his fuel gave out. 5 days later, he completely abandoned Albania, telling his aide, "I am disgusted by this environment. We haven't advanced one step. They've been deceiving me to this very day. I have a profound contempt for all these people. By these people, he meant both Albanian allies as well as his own high command. It is true that at this point, he was being told what he wanted to hear. But this is the contempt that people had for him. Now, the core of the matter is he had to ask for German support, which was a massive humiliation for Mussolini. Bulgaria was ordered to join them. The Italian forces were short of manpower, training, experience, and everything else. Mussolini gained nothing and lost all of Albania. Italian casualty rate was a disaster. The Greeks only lost 5,000 men. And of 5,000 casualties, 1,200 were killed. It's unfortunate the British presence in the Balkans meant that Hitler had to use Bulgaria to pacify the area. The fact that the British Empire was supplying the Greeks as early as November of 1940, the British had landed at under General Wilson at Thessaloniki. So yes, the Germans had to intervene very, very, very reluctantly. But even the first-class German motorized infantry struggled to push the Greeks out of the northern mountains. Two fronts had to be opened for the Panzers to defeat the extremely tough little Greek army. This effort being used against the Greeks, all of this was unnecessary. It's such an outrage, what Mussolini did. The Greeks eventually surrendered to the Turks, who allied themselves with Germany. Thessaloniki was taken, and the Germans, showing great respects, let all of their POWs go home. They had no way to deal with prisoners of war anyway. The German army forced the Allies south, near Thermopylae. Again, all this unnecessary. Thessaloniki was taken, and Attica was now under threat. Both British and Greeks fled from the region via the coast of Africa. The Greeks were willing to surrender only if it was to the Germans, though, because there was a mutual respect that didn't exist with the Italians. Showing this respect, Hitler ordered that these negotiations were done in secrecy, lest Mussolini try to force himself on them. All sides knew he would just throw a tantrum, which he did, and Hitler's respect for the El Duce was just at zero. It was the Italians that brought the UK into Greece. And Hitler truly wished Mussolini would just go away and take his uniforms with him. He was no ally. Okay, now let's move to Mount Athos. Now we know why the Germans were there. Mount Athos came under the authority of the German army in 1941. Prior to that, it was under the Constitutional Charter, May 10th, 1924, then ratified in the Greek 1927 Constitution. According to the 1924 Constitution, Mount Athos received the status of a monastic republic with full self-government rights within the Greek state and under the canonical jurisdiction of the Ecumenical Patriarchate. That's where the number of monasteries was fixed at 20. Access was allowed only with the approval of the abbots, and permission to reside in one of these monasteries was granted only to Orthodox men, who automatically became Greek citizens. All major decisions regarding the economic and administrative organization were made within the Synodia, the Holy Kynod, representative assembly of the 20 monasteries. And each monastery had the freedom to manage its material assets as they saw fit, and organized their liturgical and ascetic life according to the tradition. Problem now, and that's why I had to have this very long introduction, is that Hitler now had inherited a very, very dismal situation on Mount Athos. Not all the monasteries liked the idea of coming under the sovereignty of the Greek state. 1827, now this is after the revolution, of course, the Russian monks of the monastery of St. Pantaleon of the Rusicon, also the Bulgarian monks of the Zografu, together with the Romanian monks, the Podromo Hermitage, which belonged to their, actually the Greek monastery of the Great Lavra. But they had problems. Their main problem was that all monks living there automatically became Greek citizens, which was seen as diminishing the universal spiritual role of Mount Athos. And cause a massive decrease of non-Greek monks choosing to retire to monasteries there. The German occupation, though, permitted the Athenites to take action against a far more rational state than they had been dealing with before. So by April 20th, 1941, almost all of mainland Greece succumbed to the offenses of the Axis powers, of the German powers and the Bulgarians. And Athens fell on April 27th, I think. Now, this is just before, by the way, just before Barbarossa. Hitler knew that Stalin had a massive army that was being built, being massed on the border. All of Stalin's defensive works have been destroyed. He knew that he was under threat, and yet this is what he had to deal with. Now, it was just after April 27th that Hitler's chancellor received an official letter from the Holy Synodia of Mount Athos. And it's interesting. The monasteries asked Hitler to become a personal protector of the Holy Mountain. Let me quote a piece of it here. Your Excellency, we, the undersigned pious representatives of the 20 holy, princely, and patriarchal monasteries of the Holy Mountain Athos, in our capacity as abbots and representatives of this holy place, have the great honor to address Your Excellencies and ask you most earnestly and insistently to take this holy place under your personal protection and patronage. As successor of the founders and benefactors of this holy place, the Byzantine emperors, and their descendants. The letter goes on about the importance and status of the monastic establishments in the Holy Mountain throughout history, even its relevance to Germany. The end of the letter is written in the form of almost a prayer to the authorities, containing in almost a stylized form the National Socialist Doctrine of the Volk. Says this, praying to the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, with all our hearts and souls, that he may shower your excellency with health and long life for the good of the glorious German people, we sign. Representatives of the extraordinary, full, and holy assembly of the 20 holy monasteries of Holy Mount Athos. It was a smart move on their case. And Hitler never actually stepped foot there. However, not too long later, not too long after this, St. Pantaleon and Zografu, so the Bulgarians and the Russians, on behalf, they submitted their own petition to the security office. 8 pages. Kind of the same sort of thing. Talked about the injustices to which the non-Greek monastic communities of Mount Athos were subject to, and the passage in 1920s under Greek control. Same style, the same arguments. Same methods. Even invoking the Treaty of Berlin, Article 62. And that's when they asked again, as those two monasteries, to appoint a representative of the Axis powers instead of one subordinated to Greece to redress the injustices. Let me quote some of that letter to you here. At present, in view of the fact that the Greek administrative authorities have been reinstated in Athos to the end of the Balkan struggle. And under these conditions, the oppressive regime to which we are subject will continue to exist. We would like to appeal to the Axis powers as protectors of the weak and disenfranchised, by the creators of the Versailles system in order that the representative of the Military Occupation Administration of the Axis powers be appointed on Alphos, so that this representative would not be given, would only be given duties of the Greek as political governor, whose subsequent activities were only harmful and violent, but rather be given to the task of restoring the centuries-old rights and privileges of the non-Greek monasteries on Alphos, which the Greek government violated with flagrant disregard to international treaties. And they sign it in the same kind of a way. So you had at least two letters written, one by all 20, and then this one only by two of the monasteries. The Romanians actually did a third one, but in very much with alliance with the Russians. They were under the Greek monastery of the Great Lavra anyway. In 1943, the Reich Security Office in Belgrade received a letter from the two Romanian hermitages asking for redress of the injustice imposed by the Constitutional Charter of 1924, the limitation to 20 monasteries, etc. And the Romanians said this: all the illegal measures were later legalized by the Greek Parliament with the so-called Charter of the Holy Mountain Constitutions, which aims to totally eliminate minority elements. This charter also abolished the independence of minority hermitages, cells, and hovels. In 1926, the Greek government expropriated all monastic properties outside the borders of Athos. This measure was applied to Romanian, Bulgarian, and Russians, but not to Serbs, because the property of the Serbian monastery in Hollander were not touched. All the international agreements that were also signed by the Greeks, starting with the Treaty of Berlin, 1878, 62 again, have been disregarded by the Greek government, which has consistently and scrupulously violated these international treaties. The Greek people have therefore shown themselves to be untrustworthy. So it would be necessary for the Holy Mountain to be legally subordinated to another regime, that it would no longer be exposed to political arbitration, denationalization, and Greek chauvinism. It is a flagrant injustice that we, the Romanians, who have been founders and keepers of the entire Holy Church for five centuries, we built a great monastery for Romania, and he meant Cotulmas back then. Today, the only thing we regret, we don't have a single monastery, that we do not have the right to vote in the Holy Synod, and that our few Romanian hermitages and cells are doomed to complete destruction under the Greeks. Denationalization. We talked about this in the 1872 Robber Synod, the nonsense about and the allegedly condemnation of nationalism in Bulgaria. This was all sent to the German security force in Berlin. In Belgrade. The Podromu Hermitage is larger than many of the Greek ones, but we can't be, because it's been set at 20, we can't be a major one. There were 70 Romanian cells in Athos. Even the small hermitages housed around 260 monks. Clearly, there's a pattern here. Hitler was seen not only as a fighter against Bolshevism and Marxism, but as a neutral party. They wanted the authority of the Holy Mountain to be restored, as it was in the time of the Byzantines, through the intervention out of Hitler in Germany. Of course, the most powerful state at the time outside of the USSR. So you had three petitions. Two of them mentioned the injustices of Versailles, often invoked by the Germans, as we know. We talked about the nationalization of properties outside of Athos that were, for refugees. They were given a pennies on the dollar there. But the Greek monasteries, too, were affected negatively by that measure. Now, of course, the decline of Russian and Bulgarian monasteries was caused primarily by the Bolshevik Revolution. You had no more pilgrims. The huge amount of aid you had from Russia and the Slavic Orthodox countries prior to it. The sovereignty of the Greek state, according to them, didn't make life easier for these non-Greek monks. So Hitler inherited, he agreed to this, by the way. He agreed to take it under his personal protection. He liked the idea, although he didn't like to be constantly peppered with it, since he had something more on his mind, namely the fact that the Soviet Union was massing millions of men on the border for an offensive attack against Europe and specifically Germany. And that certainly would affect Mount Athos. But once he agreed to be the protector, he then directed that everything go through the foreign ministry. Now, the Greek government at the time was headed by Sarakoglu, a general, who was very pro-German, pro-NS, and then he refused to talk about the topic any further. But he did respond favorably. The Holy Mountain was under his protection. Now, one of the security officers in Belgrade, German, Dr. Paul Dittel, wrote on April 27, 1943, during a visit to Athos, he concluded the following. After the end of the Balkan campaign in 1941, the Holy Synod of Karius addressed a petition to the Führer, asking the leader assume the patronage and protection of Mount Athos. However, the Führer decided at the time was discovered by the asking OB in Thessaloniki that he could not change anything, or for the time being, regarding the situation. However, most monks believe that the Führer has in fact taken over the protection of the Republic. Now, it's not the German state here. It's not an official matter. It's a personal matter. So that means Russian monks, St. Pantaleon, asked the great Metropolitan Seraphim Laed of Berlin in Germany. I did an entire lector on him and help in getting more food, since the monks were in danger of dying of starvation. Someone was diverting the food that the German army was allowing to go. The request was signed by Archimandrite Eugene and Priest Gabriel, submitted to the Metropolitan if they had repeatedly asked for help from the Bulgarian authorities, but were completely ignored. Now, Metropolitan Seraphim Laed, who Hitler liked very much, referred the monk's request to the Reich Ministry for Church Affairs, which then sent it to the authorities in Athens through the Foreign Ministry. So it ended up being an exchange between the German military administration in northern Greece and representatives of the Reich in Athens. The Thessalonians claimed sufficient food and materials had been delivered to these places, so no one would suffer from hunger or cold. The lack of food claimed by the Russian monks of St. Pantaleon was due to the fact that the monasteries had not shared the resources generously provided by the German army. Someone was diverting them. German Archive, 1944, mentioned sufficient food and provisions were delivered to the Holy Mount on Mount Athos through the Red Cross in Bulgaria to ensure the livelihood of all the inhabitants of the Holy Mountain. But it most certainly was under Hitler's personal, non-institutional protection. Interestingly, in June 1941, there was a mission of German officers and scientists that arrived on Mount Athos, led by the German, or actually the Austrian, Byzantinologist Franz Dolger, who knew, he knew a few monks on Athos. He had been there a few times before. He was at the University of Munich. Very sympathetic, with the aim of studying and photographing documents and manuscripts found in the libraries there. Monks were prepared. They had letters of recommendation sent to them from the Greek government, which was pro-German then. But the reality was the mission had been authorized by the security services. Not that that really matters. But when they arrived, they took about 2,000 photographs. The visit didn't leave the government indifferent. The general commander and the Greek government did draw attention. The fact that the preservation of Athenite treasures had to be a priority. This was both shared by the pro-German Greek government at the time and Germany itself. He had a whole team there. Dr. Anton Dido, religious studies at Thessaloniki, Otter Trettinger, Byzantinologist. Then you had the security people like Sergeant Major Carl Kress. He was a photographer. And Dr. Siotis, a theologian at the University of Athens. And a few translators. This was done in the best possible way. This wasn't done in bad faith at all. They paid attention to the libraries and archives of the monasteries. They were upset that they were so disorganized. They didn't have a great inventory back then. Professor Dolger made recommendations that abbots send monks to Germany for training and organization in museum collections, which is actually a separate job in and of itself. It's also mentioned in the monasteries in which the documentary collection was well preserved, like in Ephesmenium. The monks there asked for Hitler's portrait. Please, like anybody else who, they prayed for Hitler at their all services. And as they should, they asked for his portrait. In the Serbian monastery of Hollander, the swastika flag was flown, as well as Consin Monitu. And in their reception hall, there was a charcoal portrait of the Führer made from a small photograph. Advatopiedi, where the group spent a whole evening talking to the monks, where the phrase, Our Protector Hitler, was mentioned. Upon leaving the Dionysius Monastery, the abbot led a boat, carrying the expedition members and waving the swastika. The monks understood it's either the Soviet Union or the Germans. That's it. If the Soviets win, it will be an utter disaster. So they left July 31st, 1941. They published a book called Monks Landatos. Very, very supportive. Very good. 1943. Came straight out of the NSDAP treasury. Main author being, Franz Dolger. I like that they had Byzantinologists in under the Germans. The U.S. probably had zero at the time. There were a few diary entries. Lots of information. And some of these photographs have not been seen. These relics and treasures have not been seen outside of Athos before. The foreword was signed by the Berlin Chief of Staff, Gerhard Utekal. And gave credit to Hermann Ritter, the head of the security service in Greece. But Dolger, in his preface, here's what he says. It's to the credit of the security services, operational staff, then that in the spring of 1941, they recognized the advantage that the occupation of Greece by German troops gave to another successful visit by German scientists. The many difficulties which had hitherto stood in the way of a visit to the Holy Mountain were now removed, and there was a prospect of overcoming the traditional mistrust of the monks by conducting an expedition in a peaceful manner. It was a big deal. This was a connection. This book was a connection of National Socialism, of course, Metropolitan Seraphim, and Mount Athos. The last chapter shows that pencil portrait of Hitler from the Konstantinopolitan Monastery. And the text says this. In the Konstantinopolitan Monastery, A picture of our leader takes pride of place in the reception hall. A monk found the picture in an illustrated newspaper and drew a pencil sketch based on it. We were also able to see in other ways how strongly and personally the leader of the great German Reich impressed the imagination of the men of Athos. And here's how the work concludes. The experience of photography, the miraculous image throughout Athos was delightful. Looking at it from the Athenite point of view, it was extraordinarily, it was a huge concession that we were given permission to photograph the holy icon, Panagia, without any hesitation. The monks even helped with the preparatory work for the photography. An elderly monk who came and looked at these preparations shook his head and said, "If you wanted to want a photograph of Panagia, you won't have much luck, because Panagia has never allowed itself to be photographed before." Well, it was. He said it may be, he added with sincerity, that Panagia will make an exception with you Germans and allow itself to be photographed, because the Germans stand indeed against the enemies of God, Bolshevism. That book, this is a significant connection. The monks clearly understood what was happening in the world, and that Hitler was well aware of it. Now, legally, Mount Athos was under the same regulations during World War II before. Greece, even under the Axis occupation, was governed by the Constitution of 1927. It just depended with a new government, a military government in Greece that was very, you know, pro-German. So that was a great thing that resulted here. The work of Mönchsland Athos remains huge. It's a useful material, at least from an academic point of view, especially at the time. German military administration in Greece was very attentive to the material needs of the monastics, as far as the state of the war allowed, made it possible to keep the Holy Mountain very little affected by the destruction and horrors of the war. That's what the letters to Hitler led to. Well, overall, the Italian debacle in Greece reduced Italy to the status of a second-rate power. Well, something like, you know, Belgium. You know, Japan, Germany, even Bulgaria and Romania were respected in the world's press from a military point of view. Not the case with, especially the Italy under Il Duce. He had to be rescued yet again in 1943, creating the Italian Social Republic to the north. Il Duce was driven by that one thing, to be respected, feared, be seen as a competent military leader. Public opinion meant everything to him. Well, he failed miserably in all of that. The Germans, however, were a very different story. From the Axis point of view, despite the great things that happened on Athos because of the German occupation, Mussolini's impulsive action against a peaceful country meant that, generally speaking, Greece was lost to the Axis forever. Greece never threatened Italy. The invasion had no real strategic implications and existed only to prove to Hitler how competent the Italian leadership was. It was done during a time of disaster in Africa, which again, the Germans were needed to salvage. It was a personal quest by Mussolini, and it did contain strategic considerations. It never passed the personal level. Because of Mussolini, the Axis in general looked incompetent and divided. If anything, Mussolini's stupidity gave the Allies morale boost that they needed to become more aggressive in Europe. The full strategic and psychological implications of Mussolini's failure is extensive. 1943, Mussolini was finally thrown from office, put in prison. Allies had taken Sicily and had no way of resisting them. The battle was fought mostly between the British and the Germans. Again, Hitler's special forces rescued him. Well, the point wasn't so much to save a trusted friend, but to make sure Mussolini didn't spill his guts to the Allies. He would have been a very easy prisoner to manipulate. It would also show that Germany was still quite capable militarily. They had been ground down on the Eastern Front. The Italian Social Republic, whatever virtues it may have had domestically, last till 1945, and he would be tortured, Mussolini be tortured and hanged with his mistress in public. Mussolini was and is an embarrassment to Italy and to anti-communism in general. His arrogance would be funny, except that 1.5 million Italians, that including civilians, were killed between June 1940 and May 1945. 500,000 Italian soldiers were killed in this era. 200,000 were lost in Sicily alone. While Germany, who needed every bullet to be accounted for, lost 150,000 men in Italy and a huge number of POWs in Africa. The Greek campaign is one of the most tremendous examples of nationalist heroism, by the Greeks, that is, and it should be respected, despite its effect on the Allies. The defeats of Italy are not a reflection on Italians, but they are laid entirely at Mussolini's feet. But this background information as to Mussolini, his invasion of Greece, that has to be understood before any conception of Hitler's policy in Germany, especially in Athos, is to be understood. Everything exists in context. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.